The following podcast is a presentation of Project Entertainment Network.
Welcome to Vicious Whispers with Mark Tullius, your source for horror, sci-fi, suspense, and all things violent.
Thank you so much for joining me today on Vicious Whispers with Mark Tullius. Today we have episode 62. At the end of it, we will be sharing chapter 10 of Ain't No Messiah. That audiobook is now out, so you could buy it anywhere. They sell audiobooks, or just listen to it here for free. Go back, I believe, 8 episodes, and you can hear it from the start. Hopefully you guys are enjoying that story. I'm looking forward to writing book 2. It's just going to take me a while before I get to that. Maybe I'll discuss where I'm at with all the writing projects. It kind of helps me, too, to know... I think I mentioned before, it can be pretty overwhelming having way too many projects. So I'm looking forward to getting into that one. That one's called The Bridge right now. That's a working title. I think it was like 8 or 9 years ago. I had half of it written, maybe a little bit less. And then I put it to the side, worked on other projects. Then I did Messiah. Originally The Bridge was going to be the first book. Then I realized Messiah and I wrote that book. Made that the first one in the series. So eventually I will get to that series. I'm guessing it's going to be later this year or early next year. Right now I'm pretty excited because I finally... Well, I shouldn't say I finished Beyond Brightside because it is not finished. But I did finish this last pass. I know exactly everything that happens. There might be a tiny bit added to a couple of the smaller scenes. And it's still on the smaller side overall, which I'm not too happy about. Original Brightside was 73,000 words. This one right now I'm at 69,000. I believe after this last round of edits from my sister and then me going over it and beefing up a little bit more, it should probably be about the same size. I'm working on the cover. I got the first draft of the cover today. I need to give that artist some notes so he can rearrange it to make it exactly what I want. But I think it still looks pretty cool, even what he gave me. What other good news? I just got Try Not to Die in the Pandemic from John Palisano. Now I'm going to go through and edit it, I'm guessing, and put my touch on it. That's probably going to take me about a month. So I think between Beyond Brightside and Trying Not to Die in the Pandemic, I think I could have both of those done in about a month's time. And then we'll start putting them out for reviews. And then be able to release it probably October, November, something like that. Need to give it enough time to get good enough reviews. Steve Montgomery is busy working on his scenes. He already wrote a lot. I forget what the word count is, but a very, very solid first draft of the entire book for Try Not to Die Super High. And now we're just breaking down each scene. He's fleshing out each scene. I think he'll probably be done in about a month's time. I'll go through it again. That'll probably be about another month of my time fixing up that book, but it still will give us probably a November or December release date, which is awesome. What else? There was something else cool I was going to mention, but I completely forgot. I also can't remember whether or not last week I talked to you about the decision to finish up the Brain book. I believe I was talking about that, where I've decided that it no longer makes sense to try to make it as big and as long as I had originally anticipated. There are a lot of different therapies I wanted to try out. I wanted to go to the Amen Clinic and get my brain scanned there. I wanted to do, certain chapters on each of these different therapies that I was doing. But I'm realizing that's just not necessary. It's not needed. I don't want to do it. So if I don't want to do it, then it makes absolutely no sense in doing it. I'm all about, doing what makes me happy. Creating fiction makes me happy. Working on brain books does not. I shouldn't say that. It's been a great thing that I did this brain book, that I did the research, that I've done all this, because the changes have been incredible. Sometimes I forget that, But hopefully you guys will like this next little article I wrote. We made a 15-minute video of it. I recorded this article called Paying the Price that I recently wrote, and my friend Michael Plaster edited it together. Hopefully you guys like that. If you do, please share it with friends and family that might have traumatic brain injuries, whether they played football, fought, had car accidents, even a small blow to the head can do it. They might be dealing with some lasting effects that they just had no idea you can get from a concussion. So, after you watch it, if you like it, please share it. You can either share this podcast or just share the video. I'm putting it up separately on my YouTube page. So the article is called Paying the Price. Also put it in a blog. That way, someone would rather read it. But I believe what I think, so I'm not saying that I have CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or that I will develop it. I'm also not saying that I cured myself of it and will never get it, but what I do believe is that I have improved my chances of not getting it and minimizing the effects of it. But yeah, without a doubt, I've had traumatic brain injury. So that's, you could see it. Just any doctor would say that, especially the doctors that I've examined my brain. And so yeah, I've had plenty of traumatic brain injuries, so many concussions where I've been knocked out, but I don't need to talk about it because you're going to watch this video. So hopefully you guys enjoy the video. After the video, we'll go straight into Ain't No Messiah, Chapter 10, narrated by Rick Cheddar. That's it for me. I got a lot of stuff to do. I'm going to go do some schoolwork with my son and all that fun stuff. But I hope you guys have an incredible week, and I will talk to you next week. Later. Paying the Price. Last year I hit a pretty hard depression. Part of it was physical, not being able to train jiu-jitsu or practice yoga due to neck, back, and shoulder issues. The other part was mental. The research for my book on traumatic brain injuries and chronic traumatic encephalopathy weighing me down. I couldn't stop thinking about Junior Seau and Andre Waters killing themselves. Aaron Hernandez and his ravaged brain, convicted of the murder of a friend. I worried about Gary Goodrich and my numerous MMA friends dealing with varying degrees of brain damage. My thoughts would often turn to a former boxing opponent and sparring partner whose speech had become difficult to understand, his emotions a mess. I was burdened with the knowledge that a Brown University teammate who spent the last 6 years dealing with CTE symptoms only had a short time to live thanks to the combination of the neurodegenerative disease and acute myeloid leukemia. This man who'd been told he had the frontal lobe of a 75-year-old rattled off stories about myself that I can't even recollect, my time at Brown and much of my life, a messy blur. I told myself to get over it. I was making this into something bigger than it needed to be. I hadn't had nearly the amount of head trauma many NFL players had. Except for excessive caffeine and cannabis use, I've led a healthy lifestyle over the last decade. And if my brain was deteriorating further, surely I'd be aware of it. But I couldn't deny that feeling was back. The one I'd kept at bay through yoga, jiu-jitsu, cognitive therapy, meditation, cold therapy, alcohol, and psychedelics. That dark, scary feeling I had since I was 10, if not younger. The mixture of rage and depression didn't compute. It used to for the explosive child, the troubled teenager, the failed fighter, the loser who never did a damn thing with his degree. But that was another life. My life was beautiful now, with a wonderful wife and two incredible children. We were set financially and everyone was healthy. I had close friends, a good support system, was publishing books at a proficient rate, and had found a balance between family and writing. The story I'd been telling myself was that I had lucked out and was blessed with a resilient brain, all of the concussions and knockouts free of any lasting effects. Anyone that's read my fiction knows I'm a doom and gloom kind of guy, so maybe I'm just hardwired to focus on the negative. And even if all those brain injuries did cause problems, surely I'd gotten past them by now, especially with the treatment protocol I was on. But still, I had to consider the symptoms. I opened my laptop and started a new document, realizing that if I didn't write it down, I'd forget all about it or rationalize it away. Impulsive behavior. Guilty. Whether gambling, video games, or drugs, I can be an addict. Memory loss. I can't tell you the number of times friends have shown me photos of events to prove that I was there. At a recent party, three different people laughed somewhat uncomfortably when I introduced myself to them, even though we'd been acquaintances for years. Difficulty planning and carrying out tasks. It can take me days to respond to emails. The littlest things are written down in hopes I'll one day do them. Substance abuse. 32 years of cannabis and counting, along with plenty of experimentation. Emotional instability. It's not all the time. Usually I'm a fairly happy, even sweet guy, but it doesn't take a whole lot to rock the ship. One crappy night of sleep and my emotions are all over the place. I don't respond well to confrontation. Depression or apathy. I never would have considered myself depressed until a year ago, but that's just due to the stigma behind the word. There's no denying that's what I'm experiencing. Suicidal thoughts or behavior. I struggle with this most of my life, spending too many of my college nights with a gun in my mouth. It's not something I'd ever do now that I have kids, and the urge has been dormant for the past decade, but even a trace of that self-destructiveness is something I must be aware of. So regardless of the source of damage, there's something wrong with me. Whether it was from a TBI, CTE, substance abuse, childhood scars, or good old genetics, my brain is not in a good place. That thought was depressing, but I'd written it down, given a voice to my fear. I felt a little better about it the following day, but couldn't read it without breaking into tears. Then after an honest and loving talk with my wife, something shifted and I wrote three more lines that changed everything for me. But it's all good. I'm gonna fix it. I have to. Fixing it is what I've been attempting to do since 2013, when a close friend urged me to research brain damage. He'd been photographing segments of my journey to 100 MMA gyms across the country, and was having a hard time watching me get my ass kicked by athletes half my age and with three times my talent. The more I read up on TBIs, the more I feared I had really screwed up. I was a reckless kid, experiencing my first serious concussion when I smacked my head on a schoolyard sprinkler at 6 or 7. It's impossible to count how many I'd had since, but there have been plenty. In 7 years of high school and college football, I'd lost consciousness 6 times. On top of that, I had constant trauma playing defensive line like a ram, always striking helmet to helmet. While attempting an MMA career, I was knocked out twice. On another 2 occasions, my brain was rattled so badly that I completely lost at least 15 minutes of time, and there were a ridiculous number of occasions where I left the gym with a moderate concussion. While attempting a boxing career, I constantly slurred my words and reversed their order. Between boxing and MMA, I had 14 professional matches and a losing record, a sure sign I'd taken more damage than I had dealt. Add a few motorcycle accidents and a 70-mile-per-hour car collision, and it's amazing I could write my own name, let alone a novel. The cumulative brain trauma made me a prime candidate for dementia, and was likely responsible for my spotty memory. All the aforementioned damage had been almost a decade before my latest stretch of unnecessary blows to the head, where I acquired at least 5 more concussions. My head slamming off the mat at Team Quest, nearly being knocked out at Syndicate MMA, a nasty head kick at Alliance MMA, and brutal beatings by Fabricio Verdum and Renato Babalu at Kings MMA. Although I wasn't excessively worried about my brain health, I was concerned enough to implement some recommendations I found online. I began playing games on Lumosity and a couple other platforms, my scores in the top percentiles assuring me I was fine. The other big takeaway was the importance of exercise. Not only can regular exercise relieve stress, help with pain, and improve overall well-being, it's also good for the vascular system in your brain. Fortunately, I was motivated to continue training jiu-jitsu and practicing yoga, feeling fit at the lightest weight I'd been since high school at 208 pounds. In 2015, I participated in the Professional Fighter Study at the Cleveland Clinic Lou Rovo Center for Brain Health in Las Vegas, Nevada. Filling out the paperwork about my past was depressing, but I felt better after undergoing a battery of tests, blood work, and an MRI. The head of the program, Dr. Burnick, assured me I was doing what I should to hopefully postpone or prevent a decline. On top of the exercise and better sleep, this included practicing guitar and learning German, activities that stimulate the brain. In 2018, I added Wim Hof-inspired breathing and cold water therapy to my routine, cleaned up my diet, and improved my sleep. I also began seeing a therapist, a aware that cognitive therapy could rewire the brain and perhaps help me figure out why I'd always been so dark and full of self-hate. I also wanted an unbiased person who could assess me and my personality, and then monitor how I responded to the different types of treatments. But the real motivation for going was because my marriage needed it. The therapist helped me see the ways I was failing as a spouse, and how to address issues that needed resolving. It also shed light on my perfectionism and low self-esteem. Therapy seemed to reduce my overall anger and anxiety, but it was still there. During this time, I listened to the Joe Rogan podcast, number 1056, with Dr. Mark Gordon of the Millennium Neuroregenerative Centers. Dr. Gordon described what happens when a traumatic brain injury occurs and dispelled many of the myths surrounding them. Most people assume in order to have a TBI, the individual needs to be knocked unconscious or have a very significant blow to the head. But Dr. Gordon explained the process could be started much more easily, even with a minor car accident or ride on a roller coaster. Once the injury occurs, the brain becomes inflamed, and this inflammation expands and disrupts the brain's ability to self-regulate hormones. Dr. Gordon explained how many symptoms of PTSD and TBI overlap, such as depression, anxiety, irritability, cognitive deficits, insomnia, and fatigue. In Gordon's opinion, PTSD is a manifestation of a TBI. Head injuries are often forgotten but commonly identified during detailed patient histories. His approach is to treat patients with hormone replacement therapy to reduce the injury-provoked inflammation in the brain that has compromised functioning. At the time, he claimed to have turned around the lives of over 1,500 military personnel. Although I didn't believe I needed the protocol, I talked it over with my wife and we agreed the cost of the program would be worth trying. Even if it didn't do anything for me, I could write about it in this book. It wasn't long before Dr. Gordon's daughter, Dr. Allison Gordon, went over my blood work results with me, pointing out all the ways it was consistent with someone who had TBIs. She recommended several supplements and one prescription of a natural testosterone booster to bring my hormones to normal levels. I wasn't expecting much change because I felt fine, but 2 weeks after being on the protocol, I broke down crying in my backyard. Not due to anything being wrong, but because it was the first time I fully realized just how terrible my symptoms had been. Not having the weight of the incredibly high levels of anger, depression, and irritability was overwhelming. Another 2 weeks on the protocol, and I felt as if I was in the best emotional place I'd ever been with the mental clarity I'd been lacking. I got through the rest of the year and half of 2019 before hitting the wall of emotion when I realized that despite the improvements in my functional and emotional areas, I had a long way to go. I dusted off my notes for the brain book, hoping someone from my list of experts I wanted to interview would point me in the right direction. I contacted a few people and set up interviews, only for me to cancel them because the depression still had hold of me, and I desperately wanted to distance myself from the subject. Fortunately, my sister sent me an email about the amazing results her son was having with neurofeedback, and a specialized form of chiropractic that focuses on the upper cervical area. He'd been dealing with post-concussion syndrome for quite some time, and seemed to have turned things around at Vital Head and Spine in Pasadena. Just as I had with Gordon's protocol, I discussed the treatment plan with my wife, weighing the cost versus rewards. We both somehow still believed I was fine and didn't really need it, but agreed I should at least see if the testing showed anything critical. On the NUCA, National Upper Cervical Chiropractic Association, side of the practice, the x-rays revealed small but significant shift of the two bony rings at the base of my skull. This was affecting blood flow and cerebrospinal fluid flow in and out of my brain. It was also causing my brain to get distorted messages from the sensors called mechanoreceptors in my muscles and joints, which was affecting my sense of balance and coordination. On the brain training side of things, led by Dr. Licata, the results were sobering. Despite my ability to test high on brain games and such, the integrated visual and auditory test had me pegged as ADHD and ADD. My auditory score is nearly half of those of a normal man my age. Even scarier was seeing the prevalent dark blue of my frontal lobe QEEG images, which illustrated severely underfunctioning areas of my brain. Not only was this compromising my executive functioning, but was affecting my higher brain centers from regulating my lower emotional centers. In addition, we could also see how my brain was trying to adapt to chronic poor sleep, also probably caused by my past concussions. After seeing these results, the cost of the program wasn't a factor. If I could improve my diminished brain function, I was obligated to my family to try. Although I didn't feel any significant changes immediately after the NUCA adjustments, I soon began feeling better overall, and my low back problem largely went away thanks to the improved signals from my brain balancing my body. On the neurofeedback side, I noticed feeling better after just a couple of sessions, Both my sleep and overall stress reaction were much improved. By my second week, I was so convinced it was working that I had my wife and daughter begin their own treatment protocols. By 10 sessions in, I was telling anyone who would listen just how much this training had already improved my life. After 20 sessions, I retook the IVA test and remapped my brain. My results were encouraging, no longer triggering for ADHD and revealing noticeable improvement in many areas. During the review, Dr. Licata also helped ease one of my fears. I told him I was afraid that even though I was feeling better, what if it was just a temporary fix and I would develop CTE or some form of dementia anyway? He said we know enough about the mechanisms of the disease to feel confident it shouldn't develop. A big part of this is due to the improvement of deep sleep, which is of critical importance, as this is where our body removes waste like tau and beta amyloid that wreak havoc in neurodegenerative diseases like CTE and Alzheimer's. I was also treating overall inflammation with diet and supplements, as to not continually cause new damage. I just completed my 40th session and couldn't be happier with the results of my final testing. Now my scores are higher than normal, and I no longer test for ADHD or ADD. Although the training does come with a considerable price tag, I've already begun another phase that will focus on emotional regulation and strengthening the areas we've already improved. I still have other treatments to explore and experts to interview, but I'm feeling much more hopeful now than I was at any other point of this process. By treating the functional, emotional, and structural areas, I've attained a much healthier, happier, and safer place in my life. I believe I have significantly lowered the odds I will develop CTE or any other form of dementia. It has cost quite a bit of time and money, but it's a small price to pay when considering my overall health and happiness and the well-being of my family.
Chapter 9. It was a warm August night, Mother's window wide open, the first half of Atonement finished. I turned off the DVD player, 30 minutes of white hazmat suits and brown bodies, one tiny virus, all my fault. Mother was bagging peanut brittle on the couch, she didn't bother looking up. I walked through the kitchen past all the delicious things I couldn't eat because that was our profit. I opened the door to the passage and closed it without moving. The crinkle of plastic bags, a bowl being set down on the coffee table. Mother sighed, her footsteps headed away. The TV snapped on. Friday night was the amazing race, since Father was out on deliveries and wouldn't be back until the next night. I went through the passage, let the new curtain brush my face, take me back to bath. Paul was waiting at the piano. "So what do you want to hear?" It didn't matter what Paul played or why he was there. They said it'd help me pray. I said they were right, never letting on I knew he was their spy. Whether or not she was my mother, Paul was my brother. I said, the usual, but with just one change. He'd gone through a growth spurt over the last few months and was only a few inches shorter than me, but still half my size. And there was no denying he was their child, the best of them blended into their shiny star. He stretched his long fingers and said, "What's that?" "If you hear Mother coming, switch to How Great Thou Art." "Why?" "'Cause I'm going to be outside." "You'll get us both in trouble." I walked over to the piano. "All you got to do is play the song." Paul looked at the kitchen window. "She'll know. She's in her room. I'll come right back when I hear the song. You just say I went outside to check out a noise." "I can't lie. Stop being such a homo." Paul arched up like a cat. "Don't you ever call me that." "Then don't act like one. She'll tell Father." "You know she ain't coming. Not with you keeping an eye on me." Paul didn't say he would or wouldn't. He just started playing the piano. Beautiful, but entirely way too soft and slow for my liking. I knew now what real music was, and this wasn't it. I slipped out the church's front door and into the moonlit night. Mother's curtains were closed, but I kept low until I passed her window. The commercial for Church's Chicken reminded me of my hunger. Father had made sure I knew there were people out there who wanted to hurt me, people who wanted me dead. I read it for myself in the mail he passed on, the ones spending 49 cents to share their hate. I ran to the barn, telling myself there were no demons lurking in the trees. I reached under the overturned wheelbarrow and pulled out my lantern, turning it on low once I was inside. The door cracked so I could hear Paul. The barn was close to immaculate. All the junk gone, burned, or hauled off, except the three large boxes at the base of the ladder. Up in the loft, I set the lantern on my table and opened the window, the rock and roll music nearly as loud as Paul's piano. It was coming from Jeremy's, his going-away party. He was leaving for college in Texas, determined to become one of the top movie producers of all time. He said he'd be back for the holidays, but there was no way to know if I'd ever see him again. I pulled the sheet of black plastic off the heavy bag and cardboard box. I took out the marine pamphlet Jeremy left in my hidey hole after a month of me begging. It showed how much money I'd make if I joined. I'd look like the guy on the cover, a person who commanded respect. Beneath the pamphlet lay the waterlogged book with the iron cross on the cover. I turned to the first page, where I always went. The one line of cursive spread out all blotchy blue was obviously not Father's, even though it read, "Lessons from Your Father." I'd forgotten all about the Norse book and only saw the inscription because of the letter. Along with all the hate mail I was forced to read, Father screwed up once and let by a nice one. The guy said he'd lived with my Aunt Laura and that we shared the same father. He asked why I wouldn't write back. He promised he wasn't lying. He included a photograph of him holding that same book, one Jeremy said he couldn't find online. His wide shoulders, rectangle face, and dingy blonde hair made it much harder to deny that we were related. I threw everything back in the box and tossed the rope over the beam. I gave it two enormous tugs and tied it off, swung my arms back and forth and leaned side to side, warming up like Jeremy said to. He also said to always wrap my wrists and knuckles, but I didn't need protecting. The first strike was half speed to wake my body, my right hand a hammer behind it. A person responsible for so much pain and suffering could surely handle some himself. I let my hands go. One, two, my fist sinking into the bag. Mother's sour face, Father's glare. One, two, faster and faster. All the letters I never received, all the letters I did. A flurry of fists striking harder and harder. Jeremy, my link to the real world, gone. I was back to no friends. Skin peeled back, my knuckles bleeding. The sting of each shot, the blotches left behind, images of evil feeding the fire, spilling the blood of Christ across the canvas. Paul stopped mid-song, switched to my warning. I pulled the rope free and the bag thumped to the ground. I cut the light, slid down the ladder, ran like the devil, was hot on my heels. The last 10 feet I slowed down, took two deep breaths, and wiped my forehead. Mother stood next to the piano. "Where were you?" I took my place at my kneeler. Used the time to steady my breath. Thought I heard something sneaking around out there. She looked down at my hands that were dripping on the oak. "To your room, now!" That was fine. I got up and headed for the front door. Someone from the party howled. Someone else howled back and shouted, "Fuck yeah!" I pretended like I didn't hear it and kept walking. Mother sounded tired. "You're breaking his heart, you know that, don't you?" It was the following year, less than 2 months shy of my 18th birthday. That's why I was in Father's office at 3 o'clock on a Saturday. Father got up from his desk and held his head high, kept his shoulders pulled back. Even with his glasses on, I could see his eyes trying so hard not to show fear. But he knew the time was coming, and he was terrified that I was going to screw it up. Those eyes were trying to be excited for a future where I was accepted as the Messiah, a future where nothing else mattered. "Rise, Joshua." I got up, but not fast enough. He ran a hand through his hair that had gone all gray. "Do it right." I sat back down, glad there wasn't a camera. Then I got up the right way, chin raised, eyes to God, hands at my sides as if I could fly to him like a rocket. When I looked at Father, I saw the glimmer of hope that I could do it, that I wouldn't be the world's biggest disappointment. "Good. Now show me how you'll stand." That's what I was doing, but I must have looked wrong. I drew my shoulders back a bit more and stood as tall as I could. Father held out his arms as if he was addressing the world, not some sorry kid with no clue. "Try this." My arms didn't want to do it, but I made them. They stayed up there a second, then went back down to my sides. Father said, "What's the matter?" I put my hands back up like his. "Nothing." Now deliver your speech. Say it like you've prepared. My arms went down. Here? Why not? He pointed at my feet. There's your puppet. I'm your crowd. The thought of all those eyes looking at me made me want to puke. I had to show them that they hadn't wasted their lives believing, that it wasn't just a father's stupid dream. Father wasn't far from raising his voice when he said, "You can do it." It took all I had to open my mouth. "Can I do this next week?" "You don't know it yet?" The speech was over a page long, but I did know the whole thing. It was that some of the words I couldn't bring myself to say. I looked Father in his eyes and said, "Next week I will." Father snatched a paper off his desk. "Read my copy." All that practice, speaking in front of Jeremy, had helped, but this wasn't the same. If I tried to read the speech, Father would know for sure there was a problem. "Please, next week." Father let the paper fall to his desk. "That's fine. How about we call it a day?" I tried not to sound excited when I said, "Okay." "Good. I want to show you something." "What?" He squeezed past me and opened the door, shoved me into the hallway. "You'll see." Part of me worried he might finally go for the shotgun. Another part wanted him to. But he continued to the back door. The weather was perfect, a beautiful day. The barn looked like it had been resurrected, every inch sanded down. Mother's bright red curtains hanging perfectly in each window. Father headed toward it. "We'll be getting the paint on Monday." I didn't say I knew, but we all did, thanks to the shouting match they'd had when Mother found the bank statement. She said he was out of his mind. He said she lacked faith. She laughed and called him a fool. The crack of the slap. End of discussion. "There's no rush on it, but sooner is better," Father said. "All printed up by the end of this month will be fine." My shoulders were still tender from finishing up the inside, but I kept my mouth shut and nodded. The smell of fresh paint hit me 10 feet from the door. The father got to it first and stepped inside, flipped on the light Carl had installed. Directly beneath the sparkling cross-shaped chandelier on the freshly scrubbed floor was a huge lump covered with the same black top I'd hidden my punching bag. The chair I kept in front of the ladder was over in the corner. Father took it all in. A fresh start. A new beginning. I got what he was saying. The place was spotless, all that white, so bright with the sun shining off the chandelier. Father clapped me on the back for what felt like the first time. "You did a nice job." I said thanks as I tried to guess what was under the canvas. "Go ahead. Take it off." I yanked on the top and tossed it to the side. It was a giant oval tub that must have been made from 2 trees. The bowl was big enough for a body. He asked what I thought. It was the truth when I said, "It's beautiful. It's really something else." "Took me half a year to make it." "It looks it." "I got another surprise I'm working on. It'll go right there, facing the bowl." "What?" Father's eyes got excited. "Your very own pulpit. You're gonna love it." All those people looking at me expecting me to do something I could never promise. The blood drained from my head. My hearing got fuzzy. I held on to the bowl, pretending to admire it while trying to keep my shit together. "This place will be packed. Just the congregation alone will fill it. But with the bake-off, oh, it's going to be a glorious day." Father looked up. "I'm glad we have the loft." I couldn't speak. "There's really quite a lot of room up there." I nodded, looked down at my hands, turned them over so my scarred knuckles didn't show. "How'd you like to live up there?" "Instead of under their roof, a room of my own." "Are you serious?" "It might be the best for all of us if you had your own space." That stopped whatever it was I was going to say next. I hadn't considered that I was the problem. Father took hold of my hands and made me face him. Standing eye to eye, he pressed his fingers into my knuckles and squeezed tight. "And there'll be no more of that." He was still squeezing, but I held still, acted like it didn't hurt. Punching the bag wasn't hurting anyone, but that argument would get me nowhere, so I casually said, "Yes, sir." "Good." Father dropped my hands and looked about the room, his gaze stopping at the baptismal tub. "This is going to be something special, Joshua. You just have to believe." It was impossible to look in those eyes, the little bit of hope hanging on. "I'm trying." Father shook his head. "That's not good enough. You're not a boy anymore." I know that, but Father shushed me with one finger. You hear that? Only thing I heard was my inner self screaming that I never wanted any of this shit. All I wanted was to be left alone. Then I heard the piano, a sweet girl singing to hold it against me. Father stormed out the door and toward the church. I followed a few feet back, the confrontation sure to be ugly. The door banged open and the music stopped. Paul closed his mouth, the look of pure happiness gone just like that. Mother was resting against my kneeler, watching the whole thing. Father walked up to the edge of the stage and looked right at her. What in the world is going on? Now, Charles. I was glad to be behind Father so I couldn't see his eyes. He barked, No, get inside. It's not hurting. Now. There were 5 feet between them, but Mother still flinched. Paul told her it was fine. Father said it wasn't and ordered Mother to leave. She spun around and went past the curtain, slammed the door shut. I'm sorry, Paul said. Father stayed where he was at the foot of the stage. Get over here. Paul was slow to get up. I said sorry. Father grabbed hold of Paul's arm and dragged him down. Paul yelped and wriggled free back into the pew. Spit flew off Father's lips. How dare you play that filth in the Lord's house? Britney Spears is a whore. How do you know who she is? Father's fingers flexed, curled up into the tightest ball. Usually they would stretch out wide again, but his hand wasn't opening. It was staying a fist, just like his other one. He took a step toward Paul. Why, you little shit. It's music, Paul said. What's the big freaking deal? Everyone knew freaking meant fucking. Father leapt like a lion, snatched Paul up and spun him around, one arm around Paul's throat, the other squeezing his head. Paul was making noises, pulling at Father's arm. I told him to stop, but neither of them listened, both faces growing dark as Father squeezed harder. You little shit, he said. Goddamn little shit. Paul swatted at Father's face, knocked off his glasses, slipped away. Father snatched hold of his collar, the rip long and loud. My body was trembling, but my voice had never been stronger when I shouted, Enough! Let him go! Father was breathing so hard he could barely speak. You don't tell me what to do. Paul jerked out of his torn shirt and stood beside me, rubbing his throat. I told him to go to our room. He's not going anywhere. I pushed Paul toward the door and stood in Father's way. You touch him and see what I have to say about being the Messiah. You'll be out on the street without a penny, and don't even think about the Marines. They would never take you. It was later that night, way after the front room lights blinked off. Not one word had been spoken in the 4 or 5 hours of lying in bed listening to Paul roll back and forth, back and forth. But I'd been doing a lot of thinking about what I'd been dreaming about since the first time on the bike. I made up my mind, then whispered like a little kid, I'm leaving. The top bunk creaked as Paul popped his head over the edge, his curls all I could see. I'm leaving, I said, for good. When? Another 5 minutes, maybe 10. Paul stuck his head over the side a little more, spoke softer. Where? You gonna tell? His curls shook back and forth. Georgia. We have relatives out there. If that don't work somewhere else, just not here. You aren't scared? Shit. I was beyond scared. Maybe I didn't know a lot about the world, but I knew it was evil. I knew it was full of murder and rape, war and death, fire and floods, death everywhere. Cults on every corner, murderers never getting caught. That was the world I'd be entering. But I didn't care. Father says I got nothing to worry about, not a thing in the world I should be scared of. Paul hung his head, didn't say a word. I hated him right then and there for making me ask. I had no business bringing anyone along, especially a 12-year-old, but I said, you can come with me if you want. Might not be a bad idea. His tongue windshield wiped his bottom lip back and forth. What about Mother? What about her? She'll miss us. She'll miss you. I can't do that to her. I told him to write her a note. Tell her you're sorry. You write one already? There wasn't much sense in sugarcoating it. I got nothing to say to her. To either of them. The clock said nearly 9. I told Paul I needed to know. You coming or not? Paul turned his head toward the window, and I could make out the top of his nose, the tips of his lashes. He looked back at me and said, "What would you do if you were me?" "I'm the wrong guy to ask." "You're the only guy to ask." He deserved the truth, so I said, "I wouldn't stick around." I gave that some time to settle in. "But that's something you got to figure out on your own. Just figure it out quick." Paul said, "I'm in."
"You sure?"
"Yeah, as sure as I'm going to get." I got out of bed without a sound and watched Paul creep down like a cat. We went to the drawers and got dressed in blue jeans and t-shirts. Paul put on his shoes and socks. "What should I take?" I hadn't thought it through that far, which should have been a sign that the timing was off, but I acted like a know-it-all. "A couple sets of clothes and whatever will fit in the biggest bag you can carry." Paul pulled his bag from under the bed and filled it with clothes. "What else?"
"Anything you want to see again. Money if you got any."
He glanced over his shoulder, then studied his hands. "Can you turn around?" With all that black behind the window, I could see everything in the reflection. Paul pulling something from under the mattress and stuffing it to the bottom of his bag, digging something else out of his sock drawer and shoving it in his pocket, him whispering he was ready. He wasn't even close to being prepared, a boy with no idea what the world had in store for him, a boy with soft eyes who only knew the world from books and bad television shows. He wasn't ready at all. But neither was I, and I couldn't leave him.
"What about the note?"
"It won't help any," Paul said. "She'll think what she wants." I ripped a piece of paper from my notepad and handed him the pen. "Just tell her you're sorry. You're coming to keep me out of trouble. Document my journey." Halfway through the first line, Paul's shoulders started to hitch, the tears right behind. I shushed him while he finished. I said we'd be okay. He wiped off both cheeks, kissed the bottom of the letter like it was mother's forehead.
"You sure about this?" I asked.
"I would never blame you for a stain." Paul laid the letter on the middle of the floor. "I want to go." "Then you get to understand something. I ain't no messiah. Not no more. The second we're out of here, I'm just some dumb hick. That's what people are going to say, and we're going to let them." His perfect little curls bobbed up and down. "I understand." Instead of giving him a hug and saying I loved him, I stood there like a dick, arms crossed. "I need to hear you say it." Paul pushed past and headed for the door, sounded broken when he said, "I got it."
This has been a presentation of the Project Entertainment Network. This has been a presentation of the Project Entertainment Network.